Okay, good morning everyone. Welcome back to these lectures about regulation provided by Jari-Mikko Meriläinen. This is the second lecture from him today, and today he will be discussing even more about the actual numbers, how the current situation in the regulation is mirrored in the actual requirements for the banking sector, especially through the requirements of the Basel III agreement. So pay attention to especially to these lectures like you did yesterday also, because the weekly quiz questions this week are going to be completely based on these two lectures of Jari-Mikko. Okay, please Jari-Mikko, stage is yours.
Okay, thank you Juha. Good morning everyone. Wait a moment, I'll share my screen. Okay, this is the second and the last part of my two-part lecture. At the beginning, I'll say a few words about the SSM or single supervisory mechanism, because banking regulation, it's not only the regulation itself, it's also the organizations that do it and the staff that does it and the mandates that they have. And a significant change in the banking supervision in the euro area is the SSM that consists of the ECB and national supervisor. And this SSM is one of the two parts of the banking union. The other part is the single resolution mechanism, or the SRM. And by definition, resolution is what happens to a bank after it fails, how its operations are continued, and so on. This is the part of the process that is handled by the SRM. The SSM takes care of the supervision. The ECB directly supervises the 115 most significant banks in the euro area. Most of these are G-SIBs or O-SIIs. From yesterday, you remember global systemically important banks and other systemically important institutions. This designation of these significant banks, it's based on a criteria, and together these 115 banks, they hold about 80% of banking assets in the euro area. So it is the ECB that supervises most of the banking sector in the euro area. Nonetheless, national supervisors continue to supervise the less significant institutions in the euro area, but this ECB, it has quite a lot of power in the supervisory, single supervisory mechanism. It has, so to say, top-down power. It can surpass the national supervisors in the supervising process. So the one who is leading supervision in the euro area, it's the ECB. And the SSM, it was established after the sovereign debt crisis in 2014. Lessons again were learned, and one of the main objectives of this SSM is to ensure consistent supervision in the euro area. And the ECB oversees this supervision. This is euro area. And by the way, just a few days ago, first countries that are not members of the euro area joined the banking union. Significant institutions in Croatia and Bulgaria are today supervised by the SSM. They joined the banking union from the 1st of October. By the way, if you are wondering what are those pink countries there, they are Kosovo and Montenegro. Even if they are not members of the euro area, they use the euro as their national currency. Well, that's free riding, but I believe no one has nothing against it. And how would you prevent it that in the first place? But Kosovo and Montenegro, in reality, they are part of the euro area, even if they officially are not. Probably you have spoken or at least mentioned Basel III many times. I think I personally, I mentioned it yesterday for several times. It is the current regulatory framework that was preceded by Basel II. And the Basel II came after Basel I. And before Basel I, there was no common regulatory framework, just national framework for bank supervision. The objective of this Basel I were to strengthen the soundness and stability of the banking system and to diminish competitive inequality among banks that operate internationally. That is to have a common rule book. This Basel I, looking from today, it's quite primitive, but it already includes many of the same principles that are used in Basel II or Basel III. So let's get to the regulation. Banks are very characteristic for having low equity ratios, which means that they have high leverage. They really don't have relatively that much of investor funds. They usually operate mostly on deposits, although they may have and usually have interbank funding, and also they use funding from securities. But if we simplify or generalize that the bank funding consists of investor funds and deposits, it's not, well, it's a simplification, but I can use it as an example. Compared to many other industries, a large share of bank assets is funded from liabilities. For example, think about energy or some other business. Their equity ratios are 60% or something like that. But in banking industry, equity ratio or the relative share of equity from total assets, it's usually less than 10%. And by far, the biggest single component of bank liabilities is customer deposits. Even today, on average, bank funding comes about 50% of bank funding comes from customer deposits. Here I have illustrated bank funding using my own data sets, this bank scope or bank focus data set. The blue bar, it is equity, that is the investor funds and retained profits. Then the red part is its customer deposits. And as you can see, it is easily the biggest bar in the graph. Then the green part is long-term liabilities, that is security funding from securities. And then the orange part is interbank deposits. There is sometime series effect. You can see that the green part of the bar, it decreases constantly. This is because banks began to move away from funding from securities after the financial crisis. And also the share of customer deposit funding, it increases quite a lot during the sample period. But my main point is that the share of equity, that is the share of investor funds, it's quite small relative to all other funding. And notice also that the bars are not 100%. I mean, they don't cover 100% of bank funding. This is because this is a commercial database and there are some sources of funding missing. But in any case, together, equity, customer deposits, long-term liabilities, and interbank deposits, they cover about 90% of bank funding. That is most of bank funding. But since banks have so little equity, even relatively small losses could bankrupt them. That is, if they have 9.5% of equity, if they lose 10% of their assets, they cannot anymore meet their liabilities. And bank capital or equity is needed to absorb losses. And among other things, banks are regulated and supervised to protect depositors and to prevent bank runs. This is an example. This is Iceland. Kaupthing, Glitnir, and Landsbank, they were banks that came from Iceland and they don't exist anymore. all of them bankrupted during the financial crisis of 2008 and 2009. I use this as an example of leverage. Icelandic banks, they had a business idea about internet banking. They collected deposits a lot abroad, brought them to their small country, and as a result, their banking sector, it kind of exploded in a way that it grew substantially relative to their national product. As you can see at the beginning of the sample period, the size of these three banks only, it's about the size of their GDP, but at the end of the sample period or just before the financial crisis, it's 10 times the size of their gross domestic product. And what happened in Iceland, they got a deposit run because the banks, they became insolvent because of the excess leverage. And because the customers, they deposited their deposit using internet websites, it was very easy and quick. It was equally easy and quick to withdraw their deposits. This is where when the banks, they lost their equity, the small share of equity, and they, in practice, all of them simultaneously bankrupted. It was the banking crisis in Iceland. These capital requirements were risk-weighted already in the Basel I. And risky assets, they are required to have more capital. And some assets need less capital. For instance, cash doesn't need capital at all because it's safe. You cannot lose cash that you have. Also, mortgages, they are considered to be quite safe assets because there is always the building as the collateral. But for example, corporate loans, they are considered to be more risky and banks are required to hold more capital for these corporate loans. And a large capital buffer implies a better loss absorption ability, which protects banks' depositors and creditors. The higher is the capital buffer, the bigger are the losses that the bank can take. And this in Basel, In the Basel framework, equity is divided to different type of equity. The equity of highest quality is this tier one or CET1 equity. It means common shares or the investor funds and retained earnings. There is also an additional level of this tier one or highest level equity. It includes equity that is perpetual, that is permanent, doesn't have a maturity date, but there may be a call option to this. And the next level of equity is it's of lower quality, tier two. It's less secure than tier one equity, and it absorbs losses before depositors and creditors do. For example, tier one may include instruments that have a maturity date, but these maturity dates the minimum maturity date is 5 years. So the maturities that are included in tier two, they always are very long. And all capital instruments, they have to be issued and paid in. They cannot be options or any forward contracts or anything similar. They have to be already paid in. This is a quite long list of different instruments. Lots of details. It is included in the Basel publication, this Basel III, a global regulatory framework for more resilient banks and banking systems. In the Basel III, the required minimum capital ratio is 8% to risk-weighted assets. Precisely, 4.5% of risk-weighted assets have to be funded from tier one, that is the highest level equity, and the tier one capital must be at least 6% of risk-weighted assets. and total capital that is tier one plus their lower quality tier two must be at least 8% of risk-weighted assets. And this is not a joking matter. If banks cannot meet these requirements, the immediate effect of that is that they cannot distribute any profits. And the worst outcome is that they might lose their banking license. But there is something between these two. It does not automatically mean that they mean their banking license. But this is very serious. And in generally speaking, banking regulation and regulators, they take these things very seriously. Banks have had to pay fees for very small mistakes that they have done. For example, one bank manager told me a few years ago that here in Finland, this cooperative banking group, Osuuspankit, they had to pay millions of euros because they had not collected proper information on private investors. I mean, people who invest their own savings to funds. There was in the information sheet concerning these investors or savers, there was an option to select that what is your motive or what is your objective for saving? Is it lifetime savings or retirement savings or something else? They had not selected a proper option. It was left empty. It's just a very trivial and small thing, but it was missing. So this Osuuspankki had to pay a fee of millions of euros as a punishment for not fulfilling this requirement. It's just a small and petty thing, but still it cost the banking group several millions. So these things are serious. So in the future, if you are working on something that is related on banking regulation, you should pay attention to it. And at the ECB, these things are maybe even more serious. For example, if you are a banker, if you are a member of the board, or if you are a CEO of a bank, or a major owner of a bank or something, you have to deliver your whole crime history concerning your whole life cycle. Even if there is missing something, 1 year is missing, or 2 year is missing, 2 years are missing from this explanation or your criminal life cycle, they will come after you and ask that what have you done during these 2 years and why don't you have any evidence for these 2 years? But where do they set the threshold? What kind of crimes do they allow to commit in the past? Probably it's not very strict. They just want to get rid of all kind of bad guys and bandits. They don't want them to be bankers. If there is something in your history or in your past, probably it doesn't matter. I don't know the details for this, but in any case, these things are serious. Okay, sorry for slipping a bit. But these risk weights, they can be calculated using two methodologies. Easily and by far the more common is the standardized approach, which is described in the Basel framework. But there is also a second methodology for calculating risk weights. It's internal ratings-based approach. And thus, a supervisory approval is needed for this IRB approach. In the standardized approach, national regulators may allow for using external credit ratings in calculating the capital requirements. Usually, they also do that, but they may prohibit using external ratings. And the risk weights, they do not only depend on the credit rating, they also depend on the type of exposure. As I already said, whether the exposure is sovereign or corporate or bank or retail or mortgage or real estate of any or anything, there are own tables for each type of exposure. For example, this is risk weight table for corporate exposures. The higher is the credit rating, the lower is the risk weight. And as you can see, the differences between the risk weights are quite big. If a bank, I mean, if the corporate of the counterparty has a credit rating that is below BB minus, the risk weight is 150%. That is the value of the asset. It's multiplied by 1.5. And if the credit rating is higher than AA minus, I mean, at least AA minus, the risk weight is 20%. So the differences are between the extremes, they are quite significant. And this risk weight is calculated for each asset that bank has. And the capital ratio tier 1 and tier 2 together has to be all at all times at least 8% of risk weighted assets. Banks also may rely on their own internal estimates of risk components. Risk components such as probability of defaults or loss given defaults, but this has certain minimum conditions and requirements. I actually found the document that includes these conditions and requirements. It's 47 pages long. It's very detailed. There is plenty of requirements listed in this document. The objective is to get more accurate risk weights compared to those of external ratings, and only some of the largest banks use this IRB approach, and not even nearly all of them. It's much more rare than standardized approach. Maybe the reason is that it's so tricky to get a permit to use this because the conditions and requirements, they are very strict. And besides this risk-weighted capital ratio, the Basel III also introduced another capital ratio, the leverage ratio. This is to supplement the risk-weighted capital ratio. This is one of the differences between the Basel III and the Basel II frameworks. Basically, this is just the capital ratio without risk weights, and it's designed to prevent banks from building leverage even if they meet their capital requirements. They have to have equity relative to total assets or total exposures, even if they meet their regulatory capital ratio. This was introduced just a few years after the financial crisis, because one of the factors that strengthened the 2008-2009 financial crisis was the leverage that bank had. And next we go to liquidity. Another difference between Basel III and the Basel II is regulation of liquidity. Since banks transform liquid deposits into illiquid loans, they are exposed to liquidity risk. Loans have maturities. The maturities can be 30 years or 20 years or something, but deposits, they can be withdrawn immediately. That is what causes the liquidity risk for a bank. And banks may not be able to convert their loans to cash when necessary because of this maturity that they have. A bank run is a classic example of a liquidity crisis. Here I found some photos of bank runs. The first photo is from the US from 1932. It's from the Great Depression. It seems to be American Union Bank. People are queuing to get their savings from the bank. And this is from Greece from 2013. It's also a bank run, maybe in a smaller scale than in the US during the 30s. But in any case, it's the same phenomenon. People are lining up to a bank branch to get their money. But during the 2008 and 2009 financial crisis, there was no bank run, there was no deposit run. There was a liquidity crisis because the interbank markets between banks, they practically speaking froze for a moment. Banks couldn't get liquidity from the interbank markets anymore. This is again my own data set, this BankScope data set. BankScope is a commercial database. It's quite extensive. Although BankScope does not anymore exist, it's today it's called BankFocus. But in any case, this is just the mean liquidity ratio of Western European banks, of banks from 18 Western European countries. And this figure tells pretty much about the liquidity crisis in Western European banks in 2008 and 2009, also in 2010. You notice that there is a clear dip in the graph. It begins from 2008. There is a slightly decreasing angle already from 2007, but the dip begins from 2008, continues 2009, and continues until 2011 maybe, but already has recovered in 2012. And from there on, the liquid asset to total asset ratio is quite stable. This is because of the ECB's monetary policies. They play a big part in the recovery process, quantitative easing and the loose monetary policy. It seems to have worked. Even if the interbank market froze, banks were able to collect liquid assets. But as a response to the liquidity crunch, two ratios that regulate bank liquidity were introduced in the Basel III. These are the liquidity coverage ratio or the LCR and the net stable funding ratio or the NSFR. Both of these regulate liquidity, but in a different way. Oh no, sorry. Okay, first let's get to the liquidity coverage ratio. The LCR requires banks to hold a stock of high quality liquid assets such as cash. Probably cash is the most important single source of high quality liquid assets. High quality is defined in this context in such a way that it can be changed as cash immediately and without any kind of loss. And this stock has to be sufficiently large for banks to manage the net cash outflows for the next 30 days. It's a short-term liquidity ratio. Banks have to meet also this requirement. They can either increase their stock of high quality liquid assets, or they can somehow reduce the net cash outflows and meet the regulatory ratio by that way. This was introduced from 2013, so a few years after the financial crisis. Okay, I already mentioned that assets are considered to be high quality liquid assets if they can be easily and immediately converted into cash at little or no loss of value. This is the formal definition. Cash, central bank reserves, and securities that represent claims on sovereigns, central banks, the IMF, and some other public organizations, but what is important that assets issued by other banks are not included in the liquidity coverage ratio? That is, this means that interbank funding, it's not considered to be high quality liquid assets, even if it's they are liquid assets, but they are not of high enough quality to be accepted into this ratio. So this is the LCR. The stock of high quality liquid assets has to be sufficiently large. It has to be equal the total net cash outflows over the next 30 calendar days. In other words, this means that banks need to have enough, well, you could say that cash to survive for a few weeks. It's no more complicated than that. So you could think of an analogy to a buffer of cash. I think I yesterday once asked that why didn't we have anything like this before. I asked that when I was speaking about the GSIB framework. So now we are speaking about the liquidity regulation. Why didn't we have anything like this before? Why was it introduced in the Basel III? Why not already in the Basel III? Well, again, lessons were learned during the financial crisis. The financial crisis began as a liquidity crisis, then changed as a solvency crisis. We had banks that didn't know how to manage their liquidity properly. And this LCR was published as a guidance and a regulatory minimum to prevent problems that were caused by these banks that were not able to manage their liquidity in a prudent manner. And before the Basel III, they thought that deposit insurance schemes and central bank liquidity are enough to handle possible liquidity crisis. But because of the financial crisis, we know that necessarily they are not adequate. So today, liquidity is regulated in banks. And by the way, meeting this regulatory minimum, it may have caused a lot of trouble for certain banks that has kind of specialized in acquiring interbank funding. Those banks that funded their funded their assets from safer sources, maybe they were less harmed. Well, I wouldn't say harmed, but maybe they faced less trouble in meeting this regulatory minimum. And also there were a lot of banks that did everything right. They didn't have to respond to the new regulation in any way. So even if things are regulated, the regulation is tightening, it doesn't mean that all banks have to answer to that by doing something major. There are banks that have managed their liquidity and their balance sheet well. And from the academic point of view, this LCR or liquidity coverage ratio, it's a bit problematic because very specific data is needed to construct this. Net cash outflows, there is no variable for that. Sometimes cash to asset ratio is used as a proxy variable for the LCR, and also liquid asset to total asset ratio is used in the literature. And the other ratio that regulates bank liquidity is net stable funding ratio. Differently from the liquidity coverage ratio, this is not about cash outflows. It concerns the maturity mismatches between assets and liabilities. That is, assets have maturity, loans have maturities of 30 years or 20 years, but liabilities have very short maturities because they can be withdrawn usually immediately. So the NSFR is designed designs for these maturity mismatches, and it promotes funding stability. If banks have illiquid assets, they have to be funded from illiquid liabilities. That's the basic idea from this. And again, there is a regulatory minimum that banks have to meet, and banks can respond to this ratio by acquiring more stable funding or decreasing their stock of required stable funding. So if banks have assets that are liquid, they can be liquidated easily. They can use short-term funding to fund these assets. But if they have assets that are illiquid, for example, loans that have maturities of 30 years, they have to be funded from long-term or stable funding. This is a longer-term structural liquidity ratio, whereas the liquidity coverage ratio was a more shorter-term liquidity ratio. This was introduced from 2014, Basel III, the net stable funding ratio. And as the name implies, available stable funding, or ASF, consists of stable funding. Stable items, stable liabilities, they have higher weights. For example, equity or investor funds, it's considered to be the most stable form of bank funding. It has a weight of 100%. Also, customer deposits, even if they can be withdrawn immediately, usually people don't do that because of the existing deposit insurance schemes. So they have a high weight of 90%. Also, long-term liabilities that have a maturity of higher, I mean, residual maturity of at least 1 year, they have a 100% weight in the ratio. But again, interbank deposits are not included at all because they are not considered to be stable sources of bank funding during financial and liquidity crisis. And this is the same figure I showed you earlier. On average, interbank deposit to total asset ratio from 2007-2017 is 16.2%. So it's quite, and as you can see, the share of interbank funding from total funding, it doesn't decrease, at least not very much, during the sample period. So even today, even if interbank funding is not included in the NSFR or in the LCR, it's an important source of bank funding. This is because banks manage their daily liquidity quite a lot using interbank funding. Banks may be short of funding, or banks may have excess funding. That is what interbank markets exist for. Banks can always easily lend money or borrow money using these interbank markets. As for the required stable funding, or RSF, it is calculating using the same principle as the available stable funding. That is, balance sheet items, they get weights according to their liquidity risk. Cash, for instance, it has a weight of 0% because it's risk-free and because it's already cash. Mortgages have a weight of 65%. Physical commodities, this is a bit surprising. Physical commodities have a weight of 85%. There are, again, plenty of categories. There is a long and detailed list of categories and different items that have different weights. These are listed in the net stable funding ratio document. But encumbered assets have a weight of 0%. For example, if assets are used as collaterals, they are required to have stable funding for their full weight. This again may be problematic for some banks. And this is the net stable funding ratio. Banks need to have an equal amount of available stable amount to required stable amount. And again, banks can tweak both the numerator and the denominator of this ratio. They can acquire more available stable funding, or they can reduce their stock of required stable funding. And again, from the academic point of view, this is a nightmare to study, because very specific data is needed to construct the NSFR. We don't have access to data for the items that for most of the items that the NSFR includes. Loan to deposit ratio can be used to proxy it, at least with some accuracy. In any case, King 2013, that is just a moment, actually it was a moment before the official publication of argued that many banks will experience problems in meeting the minimum requirement. But banks, they already began to shift funding away from wholesale funding before the NSFR was introduced, because there was this market turmoil of 2008 and 2009 that already made banks to shift funding away from interbank deposits to customer deposit. And this does not mean that the NSFR gave no incentives. Banks gave banks no incentives, because it does. The NSFR already became a minimum standard at the beginning of the year 2018, but still there are no published studies on the development. Probably the reason is that there is no sufficient data available. But this is a figure that I took from the ECB's report, Financial Integration and Structure in the Euro Area. The blue bar is 2008, the yellow bar is 2016, and the orange bar is 2018. On the left, there are household and corporate deposits. As you can see, the orange bar is much taller than is the blue bar. That is, banks have acquired plenty of funding from household and corporate deposits, whereas wholesale market funding has decreased quite a lot. The ratio is about 20% from 2018, whereas it's almost 35% from 2008. Also, EQD ratio has increased by a few percentage points, and other liabilities, this means security funding, the relative share of that has also decreased. So bank balance sheets, they have changed. Banks use different liabilities to fund their assets. Some of this can be attributed to the change in regulation. Some of this can be attributed to the market turmoil during the financial crisis. And besides strengthening capital and liquidity, the Basel III also has other objectives. For example, the Basel III aims to protect the banking sector from periods of excessive growth. And also, the Basel III promotes more forward-looking loan loss provisions. I showed you the figure about Icelandic banking sector. There was this enormous credit growth before the financial crisis. It's a good example of the excess growth that the Basel Committee means. This is what the regulation aims to prevent in the future. How well will it succeed in that? That is what we don't know. We will see that in the future. But in any case, the Basel III includes tools to build up buffers to counter the risks that are caused by excess credit growth. And also it aims to decrease the credit growth even before the cycle peak is reached. This is what countercyclical capital buffer is designed for. It's a time-varying capital buffer that ensures that capital requirements take account of the macro financial environment. There is a benchmark for this. It is the credit to GDP guide. It is measured as a deviation of the credit to GDP ratio from its trend. That is, if the deviation, I mean, if the credit to GDP ratio is very high relative to its trend, banks need to acquire more capital. And if it's below the trend, banks do not have to acquire any capital for this counter-cyclical capital buffer. That's the reason why it's called counter-cyclical. When the cycle is high, also the capital buffer should be high. And when the credit cycle is low, there's also no reason for the counter-cyclical capital buffer, or it's released when the credit cycle is low. This was published quite early after the financial crisis, already 2010, so several years before the liquidity coverage ratio and the net stable ratio. But the Basel Committee admits that this credit to GDP necessarily does not measure the credit cycle well. It can be used, or it's recommended to be used as a common starting reference point for taking these buffer decisions. The logic is that this additional CCYB buffer is collected during upturns when the credit cycle increases, and when the credit cycle turns downwards, then the buffer is released. This then absorbs bank losses, and this reduces the risk of constrained credit supply during economic downturns. And this also may slow down the build-up of excess credit. This is the exact phrasing in the Basel document. They say that it may slow down necessarily, because it necessarily doesn't do that. This is again Santander, the bank that I used as the example yesterday. This is their lending growth, quarterly lending growth year on year. That is, I measure lending growth of Q1 values to those of Q1 one year before. So as you can see, the lending growth in Santander and also in many other banks, it's quite cyclical in any case. I don't know the details concerning Santander, but as you can see, there is a dip from 2018, in the middle of 2018, for some reason. Credit growth in Santander, it stops, freezes, it's practically zero. It increases again in 2019, but in the first quarter and second quarter of 2020, it again slows down because of the corona crisis. So Santander is supposed to collect this counter-cyclical capital buffer during upturns in credit cycle, for example in 2017 and so on, and release them in downturns to absorb losses. This is exactly the same graph that I showed you yesterday. This is it's pre-tax profit of Banco Santander. It's the Q2 when they made 8 billion euros, they didn't make 8 billion euros. 8 billions of losses, they booked 8 billions of losses. But in any case, the countercyclical capital buffer aims to prevent these very deep, extremely deep dips in bank profitability. It's released when the cycle is poor. Well, this is the credit to GDP guide or the Basel gap. The vertical lines in the figures, they show a systemic banking crisis. Then red line is the ratio itself. That is this is the amount of credit compared to the size of the GDP. And the green line is then the gap from the long term. I mean, the gap between the ratio and its long term trend. As you can see, the green line, this is the one that is supposed to be a trigger for the countercyclical capital buffer. Sometimes it's surprisingly well. I mean, it's timed surprisingly well with the downturns in the credit cycle. Although I deliberately chose a few good examples, United Kingdom and United States. The publication, it includes got quite many similar figures, also examples where this credit to GDP does not measure very well the credit cycle. So this gets much more complicated, these liquidity coverage ratios, net stable funding ratio, also capital ratios. They are quite easy because they are bank specific. Banks only need to meet a certain minimum threshold, and that's it. But this is when the regulators, they have to decide how much banks have to collect this countercyclical capital buffer. When do they have to collect it, and when do they have to release it? This gets a bit difficult. And well, this is Ireland. It's another good example of excess credit growth. Iceland and Ireland, those are the two probably most famous examples, countries where banking sectors failed during the financial crisis. As you can see, in Ireland, the credit to GDP ratio, it's almost 400%. Well, from 2014, that's after the, well, during the sovereign debt crisis. Well, it's 325% from 2010. Decreases quite a lot until 2011. Well, there is a visible cycle during the economic upturn or upswing from 2000 onwards. The credit cycle, I mean, the credit to GDP ratio, it increases quite rapidly. Then it becomes more volatile. Well, something happened in Ireland from 2015. Personally, I don't know what is that peak, why there is such a steep increase and followed by a steep decrease. But in any case, this is something that the countercyclical capital buffer aims to prevent excess credit growth. This is again Santander. This is from their own reports concerning their capital. This is the left bar is the regulatory requirements for 2020. There is Pillar 1, that is the Tier 1 equity, then Tier 2 equity. The CCOB, it's called Capital Conservation Buffer. It's another capital buffer that banks have. It's established above everything else. If banks have losses, it is the capital conservation buffer that absorbs the losses first. Banks have to, in euro area, banks have to have 2.5% of this capital conservation buffer. If they have less of it, banks are not allowed to distribute profits out from the bank. But what is interesting, you can see that the CCYB, the countercyclical capital buffer, it's 0.02%. That is, it's almost zero. I actually found the same figures from 2009, they did have a countercyclical capital buffer of 0.2%, but it seems that they have released the countercyclical capital buffer in the corona crisis. But why was it so small? Why was it 0.2% only? Why not 1% or something? Maybe the reason is this dip in the middle of the year 2018. Maybe they released their buffer already from here, or maybe they haven't collected the countercyclical capital buffer because the in the end the times have not been that good in Spain, in Europe, or anywhere else. But in any case, they don't have countercyclical capital buffers anymore. The little they had, it has been already released. Also, you notice that Santander has a G-SIB buffer. This is what we spoke about yesterday. It was in the lowest bucket of global systemically important banks. So it has a buffer of 1%. But in total, well, this is the left one is the requirement, then the right one, the right bar is the capital that Santander has. This is after the 8 billion loss, or together with the 3 billion tax liabilities, it was an 11 billion euro loss. They still do have 15.5% of capital of their risk-weighted assets. So they are still quite safe. They still have buffers left to absorb losses. And as of June 2020, the total equity, I took this from their balance sheet, it's 91 billion euros about. So maybe they could be able to take another 8 billion euro hit. Well, that is what I can't tell. Depends on their risk weights and so on. But it seems to be, according to these figures, Santander does not seem to be in trouble, at least not yet. And also, I mentioned that one of the objectives of the Basel III is to promote more forward-looking provisions. These loan loss provisions, or LLPs, they are funds that banks allocate for loan losses. It's an item or an expense in bank income statements. For example, the Santander, much of this 8 billion euro losses were loan loss provisions because they see that they have losses coming, so they provision some funds for loan losses. LLPs locate in the income statement, then they accumulate as loan loss reserves, that is the balance sheet item. Then the phase number three is charge off. This is when the loan losses actually are booked, and the fourth phase of this loan loss accounting then is possible reversal. In a positive case, bank may reverse some of the loan losses if they were a bit too pessimistic about the repayment rate. But this is again from my own data set, from BankScope data sets. These are the solid graph shows the loan loss provisions for European banks. As you can see, they are quite low during the economic upswing from 2005 and 2007. Then they steeply increase during the financial crisis, stay quite high during the sovereign debt crisis, and finally from 2017 they are on the pre-crisis level. Profit before tax, it decreases quite steeply during the financial crisis, and as you can see, much of the losses are caused by these loan loss provisions, but not all. And why is this Basel III promoting more forward-looking provisions, and what does it mean? Before the Basel III, we used to have a so-called IAS 39 accounting standard that was implemented in 2005. It required banks to have objective evidence for loan losses. That is, loan loss provisions, they were allocated for the loan losses that bank already had identified. This is called incurred loss approach, and its objective is to prevent earnings smoothing. Earnings smoothing means, by definition, that banks can hide profits by exaggerating their expected loan losses, or they can hide losses by provisioning too little. This is something that is very much disencouraged by the, I mean, was disencouraged by the IAS 39 accounting standard, and also the standard it managed to reduce the extent of earnings smoothing that banks do. But now, because of the experiences and lessons of the financial crisis, we are going to another direction. Under the Basel III, the LLPs become more forward-looking. This is called the expected loss approach. Banks do not need to have objective evidence for loan losses. They don't have to be allocated for loan losses that already are identified. The objective of all this is to improve the usefulness and the relevance of financial reporting, because in this incurred loss approach, financial statements that banks released, they already were obsolete and outdated even before they were released, because banks knew that they have losses coming, but they couldn't book them, they couldn't include them in their income statements because of this strict requirement of objective evidence. This is now changing, or has already changed. Banks don't need to acquire objective evidence. They can anticipate their losses in a forward-looking manner and allocate loan loss provisions accordingly. Will this increase the amount of earning smoothing in banks? Probably it will. Okay, I was again a bit too hasty. Took 1 hour to go through 46 slides, but I had quite a lot of stuff on my slides. I excluded a few things. For example, I didn't speak about this capital conservation buffer. And on top of that, there is also another buffer. It's called systemic risk buffer. Quite a lot of buffers that banks have, even though usually the logic is that the highest of these buffers is applied, not all of them. But we spoke about global systemically important banks, other systemically important institutions. These were the G-SIB and the OSI frameworks. Then today, liquidity coverage ratio, net stable funding ratio, leverage ratio, countercyclical capital buffer. In the case you work in a bank somewhere in the future, most probably you have sooner or later have to do something that is related to bank regulation. It is something that cannot be prevented. Banking regulation today, it's quite complicated. I mentioned that this Basel I, looking from today's perspective, it's quite primitive as it is. It's only a 40-page document and that's it. In central banks, they are speaking about streamlining the regulation, but even the streamlining handbook of banking regulation, it's over 300 pages long. But probably or maybe in the future, there will be some streamlining. We will see. And also, I've been working on this banking regulation for a few years. People always ask me that, what do you think about this system? What do you think? Is it good or bad? I always answer that we'll wait for the next financial crisis and see whether the system works, system functions as it designed to I personally believe that it will, even if we have this corona crisis, we have not yet heard of any bank crisis. There have been no bailouts or anything. Well, the crisis, it's just a few months old. It will get further. We will see in the future what happens. But I am sure that we are much better prepared for the crisis than we were before the financial crisis of 2008 and 2009, or the sovereign debt crisis from 2010 onwards. Oh yeah, this is all I have to say for today. Does anyone have any questions?
Okay, thanks, Jari-Mikko. This was once again a very good presentation from you, and it was very up to date. So please, students, give some questions to Jari-Mikko. This is an extremely relevant theme, and I have already designed some tricky questions from this, so be prepared to answer those in the quiz. So ask questions from Jari-Mikko now. Okay, there seems to be no questions, so people are pretty much satisfied with your presentation. Mm. So thanks again. But send Jari-Mikko questions afterwards through email if you want to have something. Mm.
By the way, I uploaded all the supplementary material to Moodle. There is an own folder, a specific folder for them. Almost everything that I used for these slides, I have these paper article names, ECB 2020, and so on. Most of these are included in the folder, just in case if you want to take a look on them. They are available for you there. But they are also available from the web. There is nothing secret in this. They all are public documents.
Okay, thanks. And also, there's going to be one theme of the home assignment two that regards this material that Jari-Mikko has given, and the three articles will be there for the purposes of writing the assignment. And obviously, this theme is very important in relation also to your possible master's thesis theme. So we are doing heavily research with Jari-Mikko all the time about these things, and we already have one published article together about these themes, and the work is continuing all the time. So if any one of you is interested about these regulation issues, then please contact us. This is an important thing. Okay, thanks very much to everyone.